WTBN 89.5 FM, Mid-Missouri source for in-depth news, diverse talk, and music of the world. It's more than radio. It's community radio. It's KOPN, your imagination station, and it's the home for Radio Orbit, coming to you every morning on Sundays, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. every week, I should say, not every morning. I don't think I could handle this if I had to do it every morning. But once a week is just lovely. And again, 2 to 5 a.m. every Sunday morning, Radio Orbit, coming to you live here on KOPN. And my name is Mike, and I'll be with you till 5 o'clock this morning. It is just a little after 2 in the morning on the 23rd of January in the year 2005. And tonight we've got a great show lined up for you. I've got an interview that I'm going to be airing in about 45 minutes with Dr. Paul LaViolette. Dr. LaViolette is a PhD astrophysicist with some incredible ideas and theories and information to share with you guys. I did the interview about a month and a half ago, and I was waiting for the right time to air it. And this weekend is the perfect time to air this interview for a number of reasons. We'll get to those coming up here. So anyway, coming up in just a little while, Dr. Paul LaViolette, an amazing astrophysicist who I've been speaking to for the last few months and whose material I've been familiar with for about the last 5 years or so, and he's an amazing guy. So get ready for that. That's coming up in just a little while. But next week I actually have a live program that's going to be I'm talking to Nick Cook, the former aerospace editor at Jane's Defense Weekly from London, and that will be a live show, and I'll have him on the air from London. And tonight's guest, Dr. Paul LaViolette, like I said, a PhD astrophysicist, a total freaking genius, and with some incredibly amazing, interesting things to tell you about the solar system and the galaxy in which you live. So we'll come back with Paul in just a little while. It's actually kind of a long interview. It went longer than we had originally anticipated because, we just kind of got going. So I'm going to have to start it a little bit earlier than I normally would, which means we kind of got to squeeze everything else in here, too. We'll do space weather in just a moment, which is kind of what we're going to devote the whole show to tonight because of what Dr. LaViolette and I talked about, and because of all the recent activity in the skies above our head. We're going to be talking primarily in this first hour about space weather and solar activity and the events on the sun over the last week. And we'll do that in just a minute here. Let me run through some upcoming guests real fast. I did the email address and the website. As I said, next week, Nick Cook, former aerospace editor for Jane's Defense Weekly, talking to me about anti-gravity technology and the incredible. So we're going to talk a little bit right now about gamma ray bursts and about galactic wave theory and some of the ideas that Dr. LaViolette is going to be discussing with us tonight. Now, I found an old story from 2003. This was from September of 2003 from The Guardian in London. And it says, "Did a gamma ray burst devastate life on Earth?" Now, before I read this story, I will preface it by saying that I don't pay, in my opinion, don't pay too much attention to the time frames that are discussed in this story, because that is a topic of great debate and one that Dr. LaViolette has, in my opinion, the correct answer to. And the theory that he has published with regard, and which his PhD was based upon, by the way, he has a PhD in systems theory from the University of Portland, Oregon, and a lot of it was based on this galactic wave theory that he proved using ice core samples in Antarctica. And in an interesting side note, in his core sample work, Dr. LaViolette actually used the reactor here at the University of Missouri to complete some of that research. So interesting how the circles connect. But in any case, let me read a little bit to you here, and then I'll read a little bit about some of Dr. LaViolette's theories, okay? All right, did a gamma ray burst devastate life on Earth? This is from London, September 26, 2003. A huge massive burst of gamma rays 443 million years ago could have caused one of Earth's worst mass extinctions, says a group of astrophysicists and paleontologists in a report carried by this week's New Scientist. Using the pattern of trilobite extinctions at the time, the scientists say the pattern meets the expected effects of a nearby gamma ray burst. Although other experts have greeted the idea with some skepticism, most agree that it deserves further investigation. GRBs, which is short for gamma ray burst, obviously, GRBs are the most powerful explosions known. As giant stars collapse into black holes, which I also refute, I don't believe in the theory of black holes, but in any case, this is just the story I'm reading from. As giant stars collapse into black holes at the end of their lives, they fire incredibly intense pulses of gamma rays from their poles that can be detected even across the universe for 10 seconds or so. All the bursts astronomers have recorded so far have come from distant galaxies and been harmless on the ground. But if one occurred within our galaxy and was aimed directly at us, the effects could be devastating, according to astrophysicist Adrian Milieu of University of Kansas in Lawrence. The Earth's atmosphere would soak up most of the gamma rays, Milieu said, but their energy would rip apart nitrogen and oxygen molecules, creating a witch's brew of nitrogen oxides, especially the toxic brown gas nitrogen dioxide that colors photochemical smog. Milieu estimates that a burst would produce enough of the gas to darken the sky, blotting out the visible sunlight reaching the Earth. Nitrogen dioxide would also destroy the ozone layer, exposing the surface life to dangerous overdose of ultraviolet radiation from the sun for more than a year until the ozone recovered. And they go on and on and on. There are many, many effects that a gamma ray burst might possibly have on the Earth. Now, it's funny that they talk about, the first thing he says is their energy would rip apart nitrogen and oxygen molecules. And then he goes on to talk about the ozone being destroyed and the fact that we wouldn't have sunlight. But I think we should talk first about the fact that oxygen molecules are being destroyed. I don't care if there's smog, if there's no oxygen. Anyway, that's just one point here. But anyway, that's just to give you an idea that this is something that is being talked about in the mainstream and is a concern of institutionalized mainstream physicists. Now, Dr. LaViolette has some different ideas on this, similar if different, but he is by far the preeminent information source on GRBs. He's been researching this stuff and writing about it for 20 years, long before most other people were even considering these things, and long before they had been, and this is a significant point, long before these things had been observed and documented. Dr. LaViolette's theories predicted them. And so with that, let me read a little bit about Dr. Paul LaViolette's idea on gamma ray bursts or galactic cosmic rays. Okay, might as well just start here. Galactic core outbursts are the most energetic phenomena taking place in the universe. Now, how funny, because... Anyway, sounds a lot like that article we just read. They probably pulled this off of his site. Anyway, the active quasar-like core of spiral galaxy PG0052251, for example, is seen to radiate 7 times as much energy as comes from all the galaxy stars combined. Most of this is emitted in the form of high-energy cosmic ray electrons accompanied by electromagnetic radiation, ranging from the radio frequency on up to the X-ray and gamma-ray frequencies. A study of astronomical and geological data reveals that cosmic ray electrons and electromagnetic radiation from a similar outburst of our own galactic core impacted our solar system near the end of the last ice age. This cosmic ray event spanned a period of several thousand years and climaxed around 14,200 years ago. Although far less intense than the PG0052 quasar outburst, it was nevertheless able to substantially affect the Earth's climate and trigger a solar terrestrial conflagration that initiated the worst animal extinction episode of the tertiary period. The effects on the sun and on the Earth's climate were not due to the galactic cosmic rays themselves, but to the cosmic dust that these cosmic rays transported into the solar system. Observations have shown that the solar system is presently immersed in a dense cloud of cosmic dust, material that is normally kept at bay by the outward pressure of the solar wind. But the arrival of this galactic cosmic ray volley, the solar wind was overpowered, and large quantities of this material were pushed inward. The sun was enveloped in a cocoon of dust that caused its spectrum to shift toward the infrared. In addition, the dust grains filling the solar system scattered radiation back to the Earth, producing an interplanetary hothouse effect that substantially increased the influx of solar radiation to the Earth. Details of this scenario are described in Dr. Paul LaViolette's book, Earth Under Fire, and in his PhD dissertation, as well as in a series of journal articles that he has published. For your information, all of this stuff can be accessed at Dr. LaViolette's website at www.etheric.com. That's etheric.com. LaViolette's research suggests that the sun also became highly active as dust and gas falling onto its surface induced extreme flaring activity. Together with the radiation influx from the sun's dust cocoon, this caused the sun's corona and photosphere to inflate, much as is observed today in dust-choked stars called T. Tauri stars. These various solar effects caused atmospheric warming and inversion conditions that facilitated glacial growth, which brought on ice age conditions. On occasions when the solar radiation influx to the Earth became particularly high, the ice age climate warmed, initiating episodes of rapid glacial melting and continental flooding. There is evidence that one particularly tragic solar flare event occurred some 12,750 years ago during a period when the sun was particularly active. This involved the release of an immense coronal mass ejection which engulfed the Earth and induced a mass animal extinction. So, there you have it. That is some snips from the research and work of Dr. Paul LaViolette, who will be having on the air here in just a moment, and an interview that I did with him just a little while back. So, anyway, we'll bring that to you in just a moment here. Let's play one more song. Kagan, your host as always, and tonight my guest is Dr. Paul LaViolette. Dr. LaViolette is the author of a number of books, including Subquantum Kinetics, Beyond the Big Bang, Genesis of the Cosmos, and Earth Under Fire. He is a brilliant creative thinker who has published many original papers in physics, astronomy, climatology, systems theory, and psychology. He is recognized in the marquee Who's Who in Science and Engineering and is the current president of the Starburst Foundation, something that we'll be talking a little bit more about later. Dr. LaViolette's discoveries, theories, and predictions, and subsequent verifications of some of these predictions make him, in my opinion, one of the most important and relevant scientists on the planet right now. And it is a true honor to have him on the program tonight. So without any more delay, let's say hello right away to Dr. Paul LaViolette. Dr. LaViolette, thank you very much for being on Radio Orbit tonight. I really do appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. How are you doing?
We're doing well tonight, and looking forward to an interesting conversation with you. As we talked a little bit off the air, some of my listeners may be familiar with some of your research and information that you deliver, but there might be an element that are not familiar as well. So maybe you could give us a little background, Dr. LaViolette, on just sort of where you came from and what your history is and how you got involved in this stuff to begin with, and then we'll talk a little bit about what those things are that that you've been working on. So,
well, I was studying physics at Johns Hopkins University for my BA degree, and became a little disconcerted with what I was being taught at that time because it didn't seem to explain a lot of questions. They were throwing a lot of theories at you that didn't seem to hang together. There was this division of science. There was no effort to weave different disciplines together.
Right, right.
And so I started doing some of my own exploration, so to speak, trying to ponder what is the nature of existence at a very fundamental level. And that, from that early time, over the years, I was developing this new approach to understanding everything, I guess. Existence is something that, or nature, doesn't really divide itself into disciplines. It's something we've done.
Right, I agree.
Try to specialize in certain areas. But it doesn't mean that nature will operate really that differently in these different fields. And as I thought about this and was pondering these things, I started developing a theory of systems, which is something that could be applied generally to all different fields, chemistry, sociology, physics, psychology.
Okay. Hey, do me a favor. Give me an idea of time frame. This was back in 80s, 70s. About when are we talking about here?
In the the late 60s.
Okay.
When I first was starting to try to develop a systems theory.
Okay.
And at that time, I wasn't aware that others had developed systems theory, because it was something that wasn't that well known. But there was a society that met, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. They'd have annual meetings together with them. And this is the approach that a lot of people followed in developing systems theory. It's because it was sort of a reaction to the specialization in science. People who were looking for a more broad synthetic view of science would often go on their own to try to follow this path.
And right.
A lot of people I met later said that that's the way they did it until they discovered that there were other people that were thinking alike.
You know, it's interesting. A lot of the people that I talk to on this program have been through similar experiences, I think. In fact, just last week I did an interview with a gentleman named Dennis McKenna, who's sort of from the same time frame as yourself, and although it was a different path, he has a very similar story. So, in any case, okay, well...
From working on this... one day after finding that there was such a thing as systems theory and reading a lot about non-equilibrium systems, these are systems that are in a state of flux, like a candle flame,
okay,
convection currents, tornadoes, these are examples.
Geopolitical situation on planet Earth, maybe?
Society,
right.
Biological organism, all these are examples of what they call open systems,
okay,
meaning that the bodies or the systems are maintained through a constant flux. And if that that change, that flux is stopped, the system deteriorates. And the law of entropy takes over at that point.
You know, it's interesting to me because we have this classical idea, you mentioned the body, we have this idea that the body is a closed system, for example, and I think that's sort of that's a misconception. We know that we have these fields, like you're talking about, that are emanating from all living things, and those fields interact with other fields, and it really isn't a closed system, even though it may appear so.
Yeah. Also, for example, every 7 years, they say, our body's made out of entirely new cells and material.
Really?
In fact, some parts of our body have turnover rates of a matter of days, some of the cell populations.
Really, where they completely replace all of the cells?
Mm. So this became an interesting focus for me, was seeing that these principles of open systems, you found them in all different disciplines. And then one day I had this realization of that these concepts could be applied to physics.
Okay.
This was after learning about this unusual chemical reaction that produced wave patterns. And I realized that this could be a model for a new approach to physics based on the open system idea.
Yeah. Now, do me a favor. Refresh my memory. I know that that imagery that we're talking about is sort of like a bullseye shape, or can also be in the shape of a spiral, I think, if I remember correctly. Is that what we're talking about?
Yes. The Belousov-Zabotinsky reaction.
Okay.
Named after the two Russian scientists who discovered this.
And what was the nature of that reaction?
It's an open system. It's a, or what they call non-equilibrium reaction, where you keep putting in reactants to keep it going,
okay.
Sort of like burning them up continuously.
Okay.
And there's a cerium ion in there that can go from one valence state to another, from valence 3 to valence 4. As the reaction proceeds at a given point in the solution, the cerium will change valence and then come back down, and so it'll oscillate back
okay.
and forth.
Okay.
And later they found that if they put in a certain dye, they could see this as a color change from red to blue. And it's, so if they stirred this continuously, it would, the whole solution in the beaker would change first from red to blue, oscillating. This was called a chemical clock. And then they found if they poured this into a dish, it would make these wave patterns.
Okay.
Which were not mechanical waves. These are chemical waves.
Hmm.
And so they look like red and blue rings.
Mm-hmm.
Like what you were saying, bullseye pattern. And what connected for me was that in physics, everything is, it's really what they're talking about is waves. Particles are waves, electromagnetic waves. And the wave theory in physics traditionally has been based on the mechanical wave model. For example, the idea of light waves, they first got that idea. The first fellow was Huygens, and he was watching waves on the Dutch Canal. And so that model has kind of stuck in physics, that mechanical wave model.
Okay, right.
And physics has sort of gone along that path.
Right.
Now, mechanical waves are something that's very accessible to observation, and so it's natural that that would have been the model to be chosen, I guess. Chemical waves, we only discovered them ourselves 40 years ago.
Okay. So the mechanistic idea is sort of the starting point, but it usually doesn't remain there if we advance.
Right. You find this at all the various disciplines in science had gone through a phase where they were once their theories were based in mechanical models.
Right.
And then as they found out more about what they were studying, they replaced those with the open system model.
Right.
Like in biology, they thought of human bodies like machines. The heart was like a mechanical pump. The brain was a cooler for the fluid. And only later they realized that, you know, it's really chemical reactions are the basis of what's going on in the cells, and these are open systems.
Right, very dynamic systems, right.
And in the case of physics, see, physics is still stuck in that early stage of development
okay.
with the mechanical models.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's the one, excuse me, it's the one one discipline where things are so far removed from direct observation that theoreticians don't really know for sure what's going on.
Right.
So it's sort of a nebulous discipline. It's open to people being maybe not being correct the first time with what they're suggesting.
Right, right.
Especially astronomy, things being so far away, you can't really bring them into a laboratory to do tests.
Yeah, I've always wondered with astrophysics and things like that, just the sheer distances involved, and then some of the detailed information that gets put out there, whether it's legitimate and valid or not. I always am just amazed that, you know, from something that may be distant light years away from us, that that X amount of information can be gathered about that, and then we have to take at least some stretch in order to believe that it's valid, you know?
Mm-hmm. Now, in physics, there's been this desire to come up with a unified field theory.
Right, for many, many years.
Something that will explain everything or unify all of physics. And I think from the way they've been doing it, that's really an impossibility. Because it's, you know, the story of the blind man and the elephant, and each blind man was touching a different part of the elephant and thought it was a different type of thing he was touching. this is kind of the way it is in physics, from the way they've been going about things, because what they do is experiments in a very specialized area, and then they see the observations, and from the observations create their theories. And so they get, like, let's say you use 100 different types of experiments with 100 different theories, and then somebody has to come along afterwards to try to make them all fit together.
Right. So you have this mishmash of all kinds of different things. Right.
Now, the approach that I use, which is a little different, what I did is to look at what happens in other areas of science where we do see what's going on, and we see that as a rule, if there is a structure, it's an open system, and it obeys certain rules, like how it's formed, for example.
Right. And that particular chemical reaction we were talking about a few minutes ago, that sort of gave you the insight into this?
Yeah, like, for example, how do those wave patterns come into being? What's the characteristic of the reactions that would cause them to create an ordered form, like a wave?
Right, right. In a system that was in disorder or disequilibrium.
Yeah, like to have a state of flux, a reaction is the first prerequisite. But then you need other things, like you need not one but more than one reaction, and they have to intersect. They have to interact.
Right.
And then there has to be looping reactions. In this case, like I was saying about the cerium, where it goes from one state to another and back again, so it creates a loop.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very important. If you don't have that loop, you can't produce waves.
Right.
So you can make these sort of basic rules, at least with the reaction system, for example. And so what I did is say, okay, we see this going on here in chemistry. What if we make this postulate and bring it into physics and say, suppose that there's an ether filling all space, sort of an ancient idea,
right?
And that it's actually an alchemic ether, it's reacting. We can write now the equations. Well, I came up with a set of 5 equations to describe this. And out of this, you get all of physical reality, in effect. I don't want to overstate my case.
Okay, well, let me ask you just a general question then, for people who are unfamiliar, perhaps. The idea of the ether, maybe you can give us a general idea of what that is. I know that certainly, as you say, in many of the ancient civilizations, certainly the Greek, and even in our own up in the early 1900s, certainly people like Nikola Tesla and Wilhelm Reich and those sorts of people were believed that the ether was real. But what is it that we're really talking about here?
It's something that sort of like the Force in Star Wars, you might say.
Okay.
Close analogy. It's something that we're all made out of, but we don't know it's there because there's no way to directly interact with it.
Okay.
So if you think of an analogy of the ocean and the waves in the ocean, matter and energy are waves, they're equivalent to waves in the ocean. And so we, as waves made out of matter and energy, we can sense other objects which are also waves, because our waves collide with the other objects' waves and we know it's there.
All right.
But to go one level down, see, we can't go to the level of what is it that's forming the waves. We don't, even physicists' tools like particle beams for their particle experiments, basically are waves colliding with other waves.
Right. So we have really no frame of reference other than the wave versus wave.
Yeah, there's
wave
no way
then
to directly prove through direct observation the existence of ether or etherons, the particles that form the ether.
Okay.
You can only infer it. You can do experiments which would only occur that way if there was an ether.
Okay.
For example, studying the speed of light. For example, there have been tests that challenged actually Einstein's theory that the speed of light is constant.
Right. There have been many stories, I think, over the last few years that talk about the changing and manipulative change in the speed of light. I think I've read both. I don't think I've read about making it go faster, but I certainly have read about experiments that have slowed it down.
Yeah. And also, there have been experiments that show just in nature normally that light travels at a different speed depending on the direction you observe.
Uh-huh. Now, it's just, this must be tied in then to the so-called redshift and the Doppler effect, that sort of idea?
No, this was actually done in a laboratory. It's the Silvertooth experiment.
Ah, okay, okay.
And he was able to show with a laser interferometer a shift of fringes depending on the direction he aimed his beams. And he was able to, from that, calculate the speed at which we were moving through the ether. And it matched very closely with what they found with the satellite experiments on the cosmic background radiation, because they found a cosmic background radiation. This is the microwave background that they claim originated from the Big Bang.
Right, this underlying radiation, right.
That it's hotter in the direction of the Leo constellation and cooler in the direction of the Aquarius constellation.
Hmm.
And the amount from that, you can calculate the speed which we're moving relative to that radiation field. And it comes out close to what Silvertooth found.
I see. Now, that kind of goes, wouldn't that kind of contradict the special and general relativity ideas?
Well, special relativity then falls on its face.
Right.
That's a direct disproof. All it takes is one experiment like that, and you have to toss the theory out. But what
right.
the problem is that special relativity has become so habitually ingrained and to the point where physicists will fight you tooth and nail to keep it there.
Right.
In other words, they want to ignore the data. And it's sort of like physics has turned into a system of religious belief.
Boy, isn't that
unfortunate. But in that aspect, we are further behind today than we were 100 years ago. I hate to say that.
And perhaps further behind than we may have been a lot longer than that, huh?
Yeah.
So let's do, I think we'll actually come back and talk a little bit later about what you just touched on, sort of this idea of science becoming religion and the sort of high priests of science making out of hand decisions about what's legitimate and what's not, and what deserves to be published and what's not, because I know that's an issue as well that we need to talk about, because it's very relevant today, and something, in fact, that that Dr. LaViolette is embroiled in the middle of right now. So we're going to talk about that a little bit later, but first let's take a break. Okay, Paul, you're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN. This is Mike Hagan, and my guest is astrophysicist Dr. Paul LaViolette. We'll be back in a few minutes. Thanks for listening. Stick around. When you started to come up with these ideas of your own and you developed subquantum kinetics, which maybe you can touch on a little bit now, that led you in a little bit of a different direction. Is that right?
Right. I called the theory subquantum kinetics, and my effort was to get it published in refereed journals, which it finally was in 1985. And then the subsequent papers were exploring astronomical, cosmological aspects, which one paper was published in 1986, a year later, in the Astrophysical Journal, which is the lead journal in astrophysics.
Certainly.
Same one that Hubble published his results in.
Right, right.
And in that, I disproved the Big Bang Theory, showing that observational data, actually supports a stationary universe with tired light behavior,
mm-hmm.
where light loses energy, as opposed to a Big Bang type of universe. That was kind of, for many years, a thorn in the side of Big Bang theorists.
And this goes back.
They couldn't disprove the conclusions. They were so well, I guess, supported by the data.
Right. And going on 19, 20 years now, so.
Well, what happened more recently, they spent millions of dollars to try to disprove my paper with programs as the Supernova Project, where they've been studying supernovas,
mm-hmm.
all this you hear in the news about accelerating universe and so on.
Right, right.
And there was another paper on the Tolman, it's called the Tolman's test, where they cited my paper and said their results disproved it. Well, I addressed both of those in the most recent edition of my book, where I took their data, and it turns out rather than disproving the tired light theory, it actually supports it and disproves the Big Bang.
Right.
It all has to do with who is what view the researchers have.
Right, you know? Right.
The same data can
mean
I think
different
that they were actually distorting the truth.
Mm-hmm.
As for the supernova study, it's flawed with what's called selection effects. The problem is that supernova, very far away, you tend to see the very bright ones because the dim ones you don't see very well, and it's the bright ones that are the ones that tend to last longer. And so from that, they've mistakenly concluded that there's a time dilation.
Uh-huh.
So this is an example. So anyway, I think that the conclusions of my original study still hold. But anyway, this was my approach. I wanted to get the theory published in refereed journals, sort of nailed down. And it was around, when was it, in the 70s, when I noticed a connection with ancient myths. It began when I was telling a roommate of my girlfriend at that time about my theory, and she happened to say, gee, that sounds a lot like the tarot. So I started studying the tarot. I took a course in it, and as I listened to the lecturer tell about the... Now, let me explain if people don't know, the tarot is a ancient system of symbols that was brought by the gypsies from Egypt in a form of a deck of cards used in fortune telling. And the first 22 cards, they're picture cards that are supposed to convey certain metaphysical principles.
Okay.
Very much like systems theory. You know, they're talking about natural principles of nature.
Okay, right.
And what I found was that the first 10, arcana, first 11, were in effect explaining my physics theory in the right order. In other words, if you had picked principles to lay down, what do you need first to create particles of matter out of an ether? That's an ether that's in a state of flux,
okay.
An open system type of ether. There would be a certain order in which you'd present your concepts, and they were exactly in the right order.
Huh.
And, of course, the guy that was lecturing didn't realize that he was pretty much explaining this physics. What was interesting was that the tarot, the esoteric tradition associated with it, is that the first 11 cards are supposed to be describing the creation of the physical universe.
Okay.
So this I found very interesting. And
give me an example of something that stuck out at you. Obviously, something struck you and said, "Hey, that reminds me of my subquantum kinetics ideas."
Okay. Well, the first number card one, for example, is representing flux. You have the magus, and he's got his hand raised, and energy is coming down to the table. The table, it's the altar. It symbolizes the physical world. Now, these are, I'm not making this up, this is what they say it represents.
Right, right, and I am familiar with, at least at a basic level, with some of this stuff, so I'm
on the altar is a cup or a chalice, coin, and a sword. And again, the tarot tradition teaches that these are associated with life, like the cup is life. The coins is symbols, and the sword is earth or material.
Okay.
And this fits beautifully because those are the three evolution vectors, or what I call evolution vectors,
okay.
In physical existence.
Okay.
If you look at all of physical existence and you classify all the systems that we have here, one is the most basic is the evolution of material systems from the atom, subatomic particle, on up to galaxies.
Right.
And then out of that is sort of given birth a new vector, which is the life evolution vector,
mm-hmm.
which which is born at the molecular level and eventually forms cells and then multicellular organisms. And then if you want to extend that, societies and global civilization.
Right.
And then from there is given birth another at the point of the human or conscious being, where for the first time now thoughts can develop, symbols, and form symbol systems and higher level systems.
Wow.
So here they were taking things that, now, even though I had developed independently these evolution vector ideas, von Bertalanffy, the father of general systems theory, had similar division of systems into these three areas. And you find them also in the ancient symbol system of Tarot.
Well, you know, and the first thing that comes to mind is the idea of the Trinity.
That's a slightly, I think that's more this idea of the union concept.
Okay.
Where you have card 1, 2, and 3. Card 2 is the duality, the division of the flux or appearance of dualities.
Right.
And then in card 3, they talk about the unions, like a union of opposites.
The opposites which were created before in card 2.
Right. Yeah. That, see, it has a certain logical
I'm with
sequence.
You. Okay. I understand.
And,
very interesting.
And finally, in the end, you have a wave pattern formed. In fact, they symbolize it in the Tarot with the Wheel of Fortune, where the beings are rotating around a wheel. So first you have the one being up and the other down, and then it reverses. It's sort of like in the yin and yang, where they talk about yin and yang.
Right.
They also talk about the oscillation of polarity there, too.
Sure, sure.
And so if you plot this out, they're describing the creation of a wave in a non-equilibrium reaction system. This is basically conveying an ancient physics through symbols.
Right.
In fact, it's the Tarot, it's tied in with the ancient Egyptian creation myths. And alchemy can be traced back to Egypt. In fact, alchemy comes from the word alchemet, which is meaning the science of Egypt.
I think chem, the root chem, K-H-E-M, was the original name of that land, actually, I think. So, yeah. Interesting, very interesting. So, okay, so the Tarot was your sort of first peek
connection
behind that veil,
and then that took me to astrology, and in parallel, I was also discovering that ancient creation myths encoded this.
Things like the Babylonian or Sumerian myths, that sort of stuff. Or how far back are we talking?
Well,
here?
The first one that was when I had gone to Portland State University to get my PhD.
Right.
I was going to study systems theory.
Okay.
This was the only university in the United States that gave a PhD in systems theory.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I was going originally to develop my physics theory there. And while there, I was studying one of the books they had given us for one of the reading assignments. The theorist had made a comparison to the ancient Babylonian creation myth about some of the concepts there. It looked like systems concepts. And that's when I realized, my gosh, it's more than what he's seeing there. He doesn't see the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw it was actually explaining this science of physical creation.
So we have this idea of mythology almost used as a metaphor.
Right, where in this case the gods, it's sort of like a little story. And the gods in the story are the principles, these principles that are operating in the universe.
Okay.
And as the story talks about what happens where the gods do this and that and they fight battles, they're describing the processes that go on in the physical universe to create, finally, in the end, the wave pattern, the primordial wave, which is the proton, as an example.
Right, so these battles may be representing interactions between different fields, et cetera.
Not fields, but because the field is something emerges
later.
More of a physical, visible phenomenon. Whereas here you're at a subquantum level.
Okay.
Where you have, if you imagine this etheric sea has not just one, but many different types of etherons, where you can label them with letters.
Mm-hmm.
And they're reacting, just like chemical reactions might be. Through these reactions, you generate variations of etherons. Let's say X and Y,
mm-hmm.
all these different types of etherons. So X and Y would, let's say, in one place X would be high and Y would be low. So that's what you call like a fluctuation. It would be equivalent to like what they talk about 0-point energy fluctuations in space.
Mm-hmm.
You've heard of this term?
Yes.
Okay. So this is the equivalent in the ether theory. You have these oscillations of the concentrations. And eventually this, if the concentration is big enough, in the myths they describe this like a battle being fought, where
right.
the concentration of, let's say, Y going up, would be like the birth of the warrior king who has not yet conquered, but he's trying to be suppressed by the destroyer god who is symbolizing entropy. And really the destroyer is really the other competing fluctuations that are also trying to emerge, but they are battling each other.
Right, and as these battles go on, they flux back and forth, etc.
And the secret, and you find that this is repeated in all these myths, that the way that the victor makes it is that he keeps his rebellion secret. He's, let's say, born in a secret place, like, for example, Orus. He's born in the swamps and kept hidden from Set, which is the god in power, who is the evil god,
mm-hmm.
Until he grows so powerful that Set can no longer defeat him. And the Tarot, it shows this pageant where now this fluctuation that he's emerged out of the ether is symbolized as a king, a warrior king, who is invincible now. So the fluctuation has now grown large enough that entropy can't destroy it. And eventually it turns into this wave. So all of these myths are metaphorically encoding something very simple, which is the creation of a single particle of matter.
All right. And if you can create one particle of matter, you can create more.
Right.
It's so, that's
ad infinitum.
Right. And so that's the basic process is how you create one.
And a metaphor that they often use is the separation of earth and sky.
Mm.
You see this in a lot of myths.
Right. You see that.
Myth where Geb and Nut separate.
Sure. You see in the Christian mythology.
The Bible, Genesis, in the Mesopotamian myth, where An and Ki separate.
You see it all over the world. You know,
China.
I was a big fan of Joseph Campbell, and still am. And although he may not have had the scientific background to make the connections that you've been able to make and develop the actual scientific theory upon it, he was fascinated by the fact that so many of these diverse cultures from tens of thousands of miles apart from one another, seemingly isolated in certain situations, all did seem to have very similar creation stories. So what does that tell us, Paul?
Well, what it's led me to conclude is that at some time in the past, there was a civilization that had this knowledge and felt, excuse me, it was very important to communicate this to the future. And so it was encoded in many different creation myths so that it could be orally transmitted.
So there was a reason why they would encode it like this for people who would say, why would they do it under the radar like this?
As you unravel this, because now what we're talking about the discovery of a vast storehouse of knowledge that has been there all along for us to find, and we hadn't previously seen it. And it's sort of like once you pick up the thread at the right place, you begin to see that it's there.
Right.
You follow it, and it leads you into a lot of avenues of discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And one is this idea that there was a major cataclysm at the end of the Ice Age. Now, I, of course, myself had heard all these stories about the burning of the earth, Noah's flood, and I didn't know whether to believe them myself.
Right.
It was only as I was going through this research that I discovered, in fact, that there was an encoding of a major cataclysm in these lores that made me start to think maybe there's something to this. And the thing is that they did it in such a sophisticated way that rivals our own method of using cryptographic techniques to communicate to extraterrestrial civilizations that kind of really woke me up. And it was such an awakening for me that I actually changed the topic of my dissertation from studying, trying to develop the physics theory, to examining whether this event had actually taken place.
Right.
And so that later became my thesis topic, where I found evidence for a cataclysm that had occurred.
Okay. And this would be something similar to maybe something like Velikovsky would have been talking about, it's a...
Well, it's actually nobody had proposed this before, except maybe a few papers had talked about the idea of gamma ray bursts from galactic centers as a possible threat, but one that might happen every 15 or 100 million years.
Oh, okay, yeah. My point was, Velikovsky certainly hadn't come up with any of the solutions or answers to the questions, but he was certainly interested in catastrophism and what seemed to be recurring catastrophes.
I had actually read Velikovsky's book before I had come up with a theory, which I found very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And he has assembled a lot of interesting stories and evidence. However, I think he was not correct in the cause, which in his case he was talking about Venus
coming
into the solar system.
Right.
The problem is that out of all the planets in the solar system, Venus has the most circular orbit of any. So if Venus was a comet, why does it have such a circular orbit? And he never explains that. And actually, it's pretty much physically impossible for Venus to have done all these antics a couple thousand years ago and now be in a perfectly circular orbit.
Right, right, right.
And there's other problems. Actually, in my book, Earth Under Fire, in the new edition, which is coming out, I will take that part of Velikovsky's theory about Venus and show what was really going on, why he thought it was a comet. It was
all right, well, good.
It had a tail on it.
Well, I tell you what, that's a good time, actually, to mention your books and the website. So let me do that real fast. For those interested, Dr. LaViolette's books and lots of other real interesting information are available at his website. That address is www.etheric.com. That's etheric.com. Etheric.com. And for those of you listening right now, it might even be worth your while to log on and go snoop around etheric.com a little bit, because it's a real neat website. And although Dr. LaViolette has some pretty sophisticated ideas and sophisticated theories, the way he walks you through it on the website is really neat, and it's actually sort of a little adventure, and you can learn a whole lot along the way. So I advise everyone, and hope that you'll go over there to etheric.com and check that out. And while you're there, all of Dr. LaViolette's publications and books are there as well, and just a whole lot of different information. So,
and there's an 800 number given there too, 1-800-715-9993. Anyway, what were we talking about?
Well, we're talking about this. These mythologies and the cataclysm that happened, what you thought happened probably around the last ice age or so.
Yeah, and relating to the myths, why they would encode them. So if there was, let's say, a civilization that was able to teach this at one time, let's just suppose,
mm-hmm.
and they met with a cataclysm where it reduced humanity to living in caves to escape from the elements or just surviving best they could living off of killing animals or whatever.
Right, so sort of just back to the Stone Age. Right.
Yeah, science could no longer have flourished as it once did. Science is sort of like a system. You have to think of this in systems terms.
Okay.
Look at our present society. The reason we have scientists and laboratories and universities is because we're kind of blessed with wealth at this time of humanity's existence.
Right. We have the benefit of all our needs being taken care of and everything's cool, so we have time to we have time to do that sort of thing.
Yeah, and to communicate ideas over time. You don't have that when people are running around in groups shooting animals.
Right,
trying to live.
Trying to take what you got and trying to survive the next day, sure.
Yeah. And so the idea they had was, well, let's encode this science and this knowledge about this cataclysm in the form of myths and legends and have them told around the fire sort of as entertaining stories to be handed down through generations. And in some cases, they actually encoded them into their rituals, their sacred rituals. Because these stories were considered probably the most important things of the human race was supposed to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was something that would determine the future survival of humanity.
Right, literally of the species, right?
And so they wanted to be redundant, so they had not just one culture, but many cultures having their own stories that were being conveyed. And you find that the concepts are strikingly preserved, even though they evolved in different cultures. You see different variations, like in some, for example, the Sumerian story just has a small sketch of the physics of creation, whereas the Egyptian stories go in great detail.
Right, a huge, elaborate, deeply detailed story.
And in the, for example, the Atlantis creation myth.
What's up with that? The Atlantis story, is that a creation story as well?
Yes, it is. Now, the Atlantis myth, there's two phases to it. The phase that's in Critias talks about the creation of Atlantis.
Right, right.
And the other part is in Timaeus, it talks about the flood. Now, the creation myth is actually encoding the same science of creation that's in the Egyptian myths and these other myths.
And that would be on the Critias part of it, right?
The Critias, right. In this case, it's Poseidon that is the god who initiates the splitting of, in this case, instead of earth and sky, it's water and earth.
Okay, okay.
And he forms Atlantis, which is this island that has a mound in the center of earth, and then a moat of water is a ring, and then a ring of land, and so on.
Right, it's like concentric rings or something, I remember. Right.
Just like these waves we've been talking about.
Ah, I get it. All right. So this is a particle or something they're describing.
Right. So what they're showing is a subatomic particle, a proton. You see how your conceptions completely cloud your understanding of the myth. Here people are running around
looking
for a physical place. Atlantis, huge. And what they should be doing is getting their electron microscopes out.
and
realizing that this was not a physical land or kingdom, that this is a metaphor. So they're making the people that are looking for Atlantis physically. And I'm not saying there's not an ancient civilization.
They could be mutually exclusive. They could be both at the same time, right?
Had coastal civilizations that are underwater today because the sea level has risen 300 feet.
Certainly. Have you seen that Yonaguni area underneath off the coast of Japan where they found that incredible huge megalithic structure underwater there? I'll have to send that to you if you haven't seen it. It's astounding.
Heard about that. Is that something recent?
It's been, I'd say, probably going on 5 or 6 years now.
Yeah, I think I've heard about that.
Yeah.
Right.
In any case, okay.
So you find it here, something you don't find in any of the other myths, in that they've actually made a diagram of the darn thing. And encoded it even to the specifications of how wide is each moat and ring. I mean, Plato gives some considerable detail.
Right, if I remember right, in Plato's writings, he actually talks about the width of these rings or whatever, the distance from the ring to the water, that sort of thing.
Now, I've gotten in arguments with Atlantis. What do you call enthusiasts?
Okay. Guys that are physically looking for
it. Who were angry at me. This was at a conference, a symposium on Atlantis and ancient catastrophes.
Mm-hmm.
And they were angry at the fact that I would suggest that this is metaphorical. And I pointed out to them, well, don't blame me, blame Plato, because he's the one that said it, says this is not to be taken literally.
Right, shoot the
and
messenger.
He gives an example. He says, look, for example, the myth of Phaethon, which the Greeks talked about, the burning of the earth. It's the story of the burning of the earth.
Do me a favor, refresh us real fast. I'm not real familiar with that story.
The story of Phaethon?
Yeah.
And the sun chariot. Well, this is where the son of the... sun god, who was just a mortal boy, wanted to run his father's horses, which the sun was pulled across the sky.
Okay, okay.
A chariot. And so his classmates didn't believe that he was the sun, and they said, well, prove it to us. So he said, okay, you know. And so his father granted him this wish. Okay, I'll let you do it. He didn't want to, but he finally gave in to his son. So, well, the boy was very inept, as it turned out, and his horses sensed that it wasn't the sun god there, it was the sun, and they could do what they wanted, so they got off the course. And he started going out where the constellations are, and when the chariot came near Scorpio, the horses got frightened by the stinger of Scorpio, which is a very important point of the myth, because it's... the Scorpio constellation is in the general area of the galactic center.
Okay, and that's an indicator of some sort, I'm guessing, so.
Yeah, and it's actually the galactic center which does the stinging in this case because it sends out explosively cosmic rays that bring about these disasters. But it's at that point the horses are frightened and they go into a stampede and bringing the sun very close to the earth and it's scorching and the surface and setting it aflame.
Oh.
And so on. Finally, Phaethon is tossed in the sea burning. And
okay.
And the sun is there surrounded in smoke for days and days, and there's darkness and all sorts of...
all manner of nastiness, right.
So Plato is saying that this on the surface looks like just a story, an entertaining story, but he says actually it's symbolic of things that actually occurred on Earth that are dealing with astronomical events. And so he's pretty much telling you right there.
Right.
But he doesn't go in to say what it is to decipher the symbolism of Atlantis or what it is behind this story of Phaethon. You can say because Plato was an initiate,
mm-hmm.
and they were barred from explaining the secrets.
Right. This knowledge was held pretty closely, and it was transmitted to new initiates through secret schools and this sort of thing, and it was pretty tightly held, right?
Yes, and there was reason for that. I mean, they could tell the myths because they wanted those myths out there. And they could say, yes, there is a very important significance, metaphorical significance.
Right.
But they didn't want to say what it is because, well, one, it could probably frighten people. Second, if somebody knew what it said, some philosopher would come along and say, well, I disagree with that theory. I think the universe is this way. And pretty soon it would completely erase the prior knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So by keeping it secret and protecting it, that's how... it was able to preserve itself unchanged.
And doesn't the knowledge of the information that's being transmitted through these myths, if you can decode it, if you can find out some of these secrets, doesn't that lead to, is it possible that would lead to much greater technologies and much greater ideas of how to make things work in the physical? I mean, in other, are there practical applications that people would want to keep secret too?
Well, it, as it turns out, for example, this ancient physics leads to an understanding of control of gravity.
Okay.
The development of gravity propulsion drives, what we observe a UFO is using. This may sound real hokey for you just to hear me saying this, but I can tell you that there are experiments which, you know, you can go read the papers on the Internet, like Botklinoff's work and others. It's stuff that sounds like science fiction if you really understand what it is. But these are realities.
Right.
We're living in a very fast-paced period now.
Right, and there are things changing very quickly, and there are a lot of things that are happening that people have no idea about. You know, this idea of anti-gravity or zero-gravity propulsion and stuff, certainly there's a basis, established basis in science. We know that in the early 1900s, people like Schauberger and Tesla and all these guys were messing with the relationship between electricity and gravity.
Yeah, and you hit it. It apparently there's a connection between electricity and gravity, between electric field and gravitational field.
Right, which makes perfect sense intuitively. In other words, you know, you have this three-way thing between electricity, magnetism, and gravity, and it seems crazy to think that, okay, electricity and magnetism are related, magnetism and gravity are, but electricity and gravity aren't, you know?
Mm-hmm.
In any case, okay.
And you see, that's something that general relativity, which is our current theory of gravity, is the established view of gravity, doesn't make any connection.
Right.
Between
says
electricity and gravity. In fact, Einstein was puzzled this till his death. He was trying to form a unification to bring electrostatics in somehow and to tie it in with gravity. And the best unified theories would say, oh, we need particle energies or, you know, accelerate particles to trillions of electron volts, more than that, actually, quadrillions. And up there somewhere at that very high energy, we might find that the two fields are unified. Well, the truth is that they've done experiments to show gravitational effects of electric fields at just voltages of 100,000 volts or
right,
so.
Right, right.
And actually, subquantum kinetics predicts this connection between electricity and gravity.
Uh-huh.
And now, subquantum kinetics is sort of a mirroring of this ancient science. Even though I didn't base it on the ancient science, I discovered the connection later.
Right, right. And I realized that, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about your work in subquantum kinetics before we talked about the connection to the ancients and the mythology and all this stuff, because I want people to be very clear that the original basis for all of these ideas and theories and proofs were based right there in the institutionalized mainstream. So,
yeah, I've been very careful in developing this because, you know, as soon as you start bringing, saying, okay, your idea is based on some speculation of ancient religions or philosophy, nobody's going to believe what you say.
Right, right. They discount it right out of hand.
Yeah. I mean, and there's a lot of theories like that that are really based on a belief system.
Mm-hmm.
And what's been through my life is the interest to understand reality and try to see what's going on and not relate it to necessarily what other people have written at first, you know. Just try to see based on how can we plug this into the existing structure of science,
right.
And system theory is part of the existing structure of science.
Right.
It's a very interdisciplinary structure, which is very good to build on, and that's where I've built this edifice of subquantum kinetics.
All right, this is Mike here. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN. We'll be back in just a minute to continue this interview with Dr. Paul LaViolette, and I hope you're enjoying it. In the meantime, and we're right in the middle of an interview I did not long ago with Dr. Paul LaViolette. We're going to get right back to that right now. Okay. Well, hey, let's get back to the idea of catastrophism and this idea that there may be a recurring a recurring sort of nightmare that the ancients may have been trying to tell us about or warn us about, or you mentioned earlier some ideas of galactic core outbursts. I have a feeling that that's probably related to this. Let's maybe you could go a little bit deeper into that.
Well, it's sort of like we live on the edge of a volcano that every so many thousands of years erupts. In this case, you see a tendency to erupt with major eruptions every 13,000 years or so,
okay,
plus or minus 3,000. Then you have some minor eruptions, smaller outbursts. But the major eruptions are big enough that they can cause climatic changes. And if you look at the record of the past, the Ice Age record, you never had an interglacial like we have that lasts much longer than what we have now, which is 11,000 years. And this, the reason is because of these outbursts and the changes of climate, according to what I had proposed back in the 80s, is due to these follies of cosmic rays that come to us from the galactic center. Now, this is not just all hand-waving. I had created tests to check the hypothesis, and they all came out positive in favor of it. And then I published predictions, and now I have something like 13 or 14 predictions that were previously published, which have now been verified.
Yeah, some of which are real, really significant, and I would advise again people who are interested in this to go to etheric.com, www.etheric.com, and you can actually go to Dr. Laviolette's website there, and he has a page where these predictions and verifications of them are posted. Real interesting stuff. So.
I worked on this for my PhD. It so blew me away when I discovered that this thing had apparently really happened.
Now, how do we know about the recurring idea? You said that these in-between time periods never last more than 11, 12,000 years or so. How, do we see that in the geologic record, or how do we know these
well,
time
the best
frames?
Record is the ice core record.
Ah, okay. So
they've done a detailed climatic profile, going back 250,000 years, but then going further back is the sedimentary record, like I think what you were talking about, which is a little rougher, but you can go back like 3 million years. The present ice epoch we have is between 2 and 3 million years long.
Okay.
And it's been oscillating into ice ages within that period.
Wow.
And I believe the reason we're in an ice epoch is because, see, you need not only the cosmic rays. See, there's two factors here. It's the cosmic ray volleys that come to us from 23,000 light years away from the galactic center.
Okay.
The galactic center being in the vicinity of the Scorpio Sagittarius constellation.
Right.
In that area. But you also need a lot of dust in the environment of the sun to get pushed into the solar system, and that's what causes the climatic changes.
Hmm.
And if you look around, just seeing what other astronomers have written, you find that, lo and behold, there was a supernova explosion that went off a few million years ago. And we are now engulfed in the shell of that supernova explosion. It's called the North Polar Spur.
Mm-hmm.
And so not only there's dust, but also masses, cometary bodies that are debris left over from that explosion.
Sure.
That has created sort of a debris field. That
sure, all manner
through.
Of things, I'm sure.
And this is the source of the long-period comets. These are comets that come in and go out. And astronomers previously, not realizing that we're in this debris field, they were postulating a sphere of comets around the solar system.
Right, the idea of the Oort cloud, that
the
sort
Oort
of thing.
The Oort cloud, right.
Right.
That things would jostle them to come in every so often. Well, the other way to look at it is, well, maybe it's just because we are passing through a region that's full of these. It's not just around our solar system. It's
right.
It's a huge area of light years and light years of this stuff. It's sort of like in Star Wars when they were going through that belt of asteroids.
You know, I'm going to add something real fast here, and it's sort of a cosmological perspective that I want to give to my listeners, because a lot of people don't realize, or they don't perceive or don't think about the fact that just as the Earth is revolving around the sun and the moon is moving around the Earth and the planets move around the sun also moves around its center, which moves around another center, and it's all these wheels within wheels, and you have to realize that the Earth and the solar system really have never been in the same place twice, and we're constantly moving through different areas of space and different parts of the galaxy, and so sure, why wouldn't we go through areas of greater or lesser concentration of things, whatever they might be, you know?
Right. So it just happens that we're in this choked up area presently, and so when we are showered with cosmic rays, they cause major problems, whereas they wouldn't otherwise.
So what's the relationship between the dust particles and this sort of thing and the cosmic rays?
Okay, well, the cosmic rays, when they arrive, I call these super waves.
Okay.
Now, I was the first to propose this idea that you have huge volleys that are of galactic size. Nobody had ever proposed that idea before because the previous theories believed that the cosmic rays would be stopped by magnetic fields in the galaxy. And later came evidence that, well, in fact, particles do travel many tens of thousands of light years without being stopped.
Right.
This was after I had talked about long-range propagation.
Dr. LaViolette, let me ask you a question for reference. We on this program, I do a segment of the show every week that I call Space Weather, and I usually talk about the sun, what's happening on the sun, and if there's any particular flare activity or CME activity and this sort of thing. As an analogy, would we be talking about sort of a similar thing, like a big giant sun in the middle of the galaxy, and if it would sort of unleash a big giant flare, sort of like we think about, except just on a much grander scale? Is that a reasonable...
Yeah, well, think about an object that, well, it might be as big as the sun or maybe twice the diameter of the sun.
Okay.
But having maybe 2 million solar masses. So the material that it's formed of would be equivalent to like a white dwarf type of star.
Okay.
Very, very dense material.
And this is the idea that this would be in the center of the galaxy as opposed to, for example, the commonly talked about idea that there's a black hole there, for
example.
Exactly.
Okay. And with this ancient physics, it explains why you would not have black holes. Black holes don't exist in this cosmology. That's kind of a negative idea anyway.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea of things being swallowed up and disappearing. And
observationally, we really don't see that. I mean, I know there's lots of things emanating from the center of the galaxy, so that doesn't just, I mean, just for a guy like me who's not even a physicist, it just doesn't make sense to me.
Black hole theory has been disproved over and over, and I have evidence for that both in Genesis of the Cosmos and in Earth Under Fire.
Right.
For example, the idea of black holes being the center of galaxies causing these explosive outbursts. The problem is they look at these quasar galaxies or cipher galaxies, and there's huge energy pouring out from the centers, from the cores, but there's no matter around the cores to get pulled in. All the matter is being blown out.
Huh.
So the question is, what fuels them? If it was a black hole, it needs fuel.
Right.
And actually, after actually looking at these things with a Hubble telescope, some of the leading astronomers began to doubt the black hole theory. And the problem, the thing that keeps them pushing the black hole model is they don't have anything else, and it would mean that they'd have to finally come to grips that physics has problems.
Oh, yeah, it's crazy. I saw a story that just came out within the last couple of days. It said that they have found another black hole. Now they say there's two black holes, or at least a couple of scientists say this now. There's not one black hole in the center of the galaxy. Now they've solved the problem by saying there's two. So it's a binary black hole, I guess. In any case, there's
so
certainly
a stretch. So if you look there, anyway, you would see is it would be so intense, so energetic, that you would not see any light at all. It would be black in that sense that you wouldn't, it would almost be invisible to our eyes.
Okay.
What you'd be seeing would be X-rays, gamma rays, which we can't really see. We'd just be bombarded with these things. Particles, cosmic ray particles. In other words, the star would be so hot, it would be radiating not light, but X-rays, gamma rays, and particles.
Okay.
and anything that was near it would get pushed out.
Right.
And this is part of the natural creation. There's no Big Bang in this ancient physics and in subquantum kinetics. Your creation is through particles materializing in the ether.
Spontaneously, basically.
Spontaneously, right? Out of, if you want to say in the context of standard physics, you say that the zero-point energy, these electric potential fluctuations that come up naturally in the vacuum, as the standard physicists would say, eventually nucleate particles. And it's a very rare process. It's something, let's say, in your living room, it would take maybe a billion years or so for a particle to materialize.
Okay.
Or I don't know if I might be off by a few orders of magnitude there.
Right. But I get the point.
It's a rare phenomenon. You know, out of all these fluctuations that every cubic centimeter has, you know, 10 to the 85th fluctuations going on, let's say, a very rare one would finally create a particle, sort of like Zeus winning his war and creating his empire, that empire being the particle. But eventually, you wait trillions of years, and you have these things get together. You have certain areas where the materialization process goes faster. You form galaxies, and at a later stage, the core of the galaxy, which it would be one of the earliest stars formed in the galaxy, but it had just had time to grow, is now in a very, you see, matter, in effect, creates more matter in its cosmology.
And it would make sense that at the center was the original.
Yeah, I see. One, this gets a little more into the technical details. It's not something you say just in how long we've been talking.
Right.
1 hour. So
no, I know. I realize there's a lot of times.
There's a lot of ramifications to it,
right.
and part of this is that we're dealing here with a nonlinear system for the ether. It's sort of where the analogy is: think of a nuclear reactor, and normally when a nuclear reactor is operating properly, it's at the critical threshold.
Right.
But then, if you're not watching it and you're not watching what you're doing, you can go into an explosive state.
Correct.
That's called supercritical condition.
Correct.
Or if you put in your control rods and you poison the reactor, it goes into subcritical condition. Okay. Well, the ether operates that way. And out in space, away from the galaxies, where the gravity potential is, if you think of a gravity well, okay, we're in a gravity well here, being in the galaxy. But away from us, in between galaxies, you would have subcritical conditions, and you'd have photons would lose energy. That's where you get the redshifting effect.
Right, the whole tired light idea.
Yeah. No, I'm not making this up. These are rigorous predictions that come out of those five equations I was telling you about.
Right, and I will add that, you know, we've only got an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours of this interview with Dr. LaViolette. So there is a tremendous amount of technical detail and research that supports all of this work, and you are more than welcome to go look at that. It's very transparent. All this stuff is out there on the web. You can see the great majority of it over at Paul's website at etheric.com, but it's not worth it to spend a whole lot of time going into detail about technical theories and this sort of thing, because, first of all, most people won't understand it anyway, but for those that would, I want them to take the time to go do it themselves. But in the meantime, we're going to we'll let you continue with it, and we will reinforce the fact that this is all stuff that has been very thoroughly researched and documented. So,
yeah. So I just wanted to make the contrast that whereas out in intergalactic space you have this loss of energy going on, inside the galaxy you have the opposite effect, light waves or photons will increase their energy over time. Instead of the redshifting, they'll blue shift. Blue shift means their frequency increases.
Ah, now this is where we get into the so-called pioneer effect. Is that right?
Right. That's a key test, which has verified my prediction.
Right, something that you were the first one to verify, as a matter of fact, many years ago.
Or predicted.
Or predicted, right.
In fact, here's the story with the Pioneer Effect. Now, is your audience familiar with what the Pioneer Effect is?
Let's do a quick description of that.
Okay, so what they were finding is they were studying the Pioneer spacecraft, and they were tracking it with the Maser signal. And around 1990, they were a little worried about the data. They noticed it was off course from where it should be. It was as if the signals coming back were higher frequency than they should be, blue shifted. And this effect wouldn't go away, so they watched it over many years. So finally, in 1992, they launched a study. And they announced it in 94. They launched a study, and by 1998, they published their results. And they were interpreting it as if there was a mysterious force pushing the spacecraft towards the sun. It was totally not predicted by any laws of physics. It became an open field day. You had everybody and their uncle were coming out and presenting theories of what this could be.
Right.
They're on the Internet, on the Internet Archive. You have dozens and dozens of theories to try to describe this. Okay. Now, I predicted this effect. Back in 79, my physics theory was predicting this blue shifting effect, and I was able to come up with an actual amount that should be observed. And 1980, I called up JPL, the same place where they found the Pioneer Effect later. In 1980, I talked with some people that were involved in the Maser signal tracking.
Right.
Because they were at that time interested in looking at the Maser signals to look for gravity waves by seeing how the signals become Doppler shifted. So I told them, would you be interested to do an experiment to look for blue shifting of signals? Because my theory predicts this. And I told them about how much you'd expect.
Okay.
And the fellow I was talking to, his reaction was, well, we're having hard enough time getting funding for our own gravity wave research. But your idea sounds interesting, you know. So It was left at that. They sent me some of their papers. Okay, so 10 years later, they probably forgot about my call. I don't know. But they come to exactly this conclusion.
Right.
I didn't get cited at all. But it turns out I published in 1985, still well before they even suspected that there was something going on.
Right, before they had even realized what they were looking for.
And I described doing a spacecraft experiment with Maser signals, sending out to Jupiter and back, and looking for this amount, and I actually stated the amount.
Right, because it's quantifiable.
And it's there in print, hard print. No one can deny it.
Right.
And I came within two standard deviations of what they found.
Wow.
Now, that's like hitting a target on Pluto with a bow and arrow.
It sure is.
A comparison.
It sure
so
is.
So I call up a fellow heading that project, and I told him about my prediction. I sent him a copy of my book. And could he send me a copy of his paper, which was about to come out in, I think, one of the major journals.
And this was 98, right?
Right. He never sent me the paper, so I couldn't see his calculations.
Mm-hmm.
It was only from something I read in the one of the news stories. And so I didn't follow it up because I didn't really know for sure, what his rate was he was observing.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it might be close. It wasn't until 4 years later when he came out with his second paper and there were more news stories that I realized, my God, I was right on.
Wow.
And he never corresponded with me. He had my book. He could have cited my prediction. He didn't. So I immediately set to work and wrote up a paper about the confirmation. Now, we're talking about, I don't want to boast here, but I think this is probably as big as Einstein's prediction of the bending of starlight.
Yeah, it's a huge thing. I mean, for people who are familiar with these subject areas, it is a huge, huge thing.
And I've been told by other colleagues of mine that this is Nobel Prize material. It means that if it's correct, we have to completely revise everything we've been doing in astronomy.
Right.
Because, for example, the amount of this effect, of this blue shifting, because you're in effect generating energy. If you take a look at the sun, for example, you add up all the photons in the sun, and you say they're generating energy at this certain rate.
Mm-hmm.
You get a sizable fraction of the sun's output being spontaneously generated energy.
Hmm.
It comes out to be around 10% in
okay.
the case of the sun. But for other planets, like Jupiter is putting out energy from its center, Saturn, the Earth, geothermal energy.
Right.
It's able to predict all these.
Yeah, and much of that stuff was unexplained in conventional methodology. So
brown dwarfs and the red dwarf stars. Turns out the red dwarf stars are entirely powered by genic energy, this spontaneously generated blue shifting energy, according to the predictions. And you can actually plot the brown dwarfs and red dwarf stars, and they end up on the same line with the planets, which would be showing that there is a common energy relation when you plot their mass against their luminosity. But that's getting a little technical.
Right.
So anyway, I've written the paper, and this gets into this Internet Archive problem.
Well, I think since we're there, I think now is a good time to mention that. And before we get too deeply into it, I will mention another website that I'd like people to go take a look at. And that is www.archivefreedom.org. That's archivefreedom.org. And there are a number of scientists that Dr. Laviolette is working with on that website to try to mediate some of the things that we're going to be talking about here in just a minute. So so that's one to bookmark, and I'll mention that again in a few minutes here. So.
Yeah. Well, I submitted this to be posted because
now let me clarify something real fast. There's apparently a scientific archive, a physics archive, that is maintained by Cornell University. I have no problem mentioning that. I think
originally it was Los Alamos, and
okay.
then the guy who developed it moved to Cornell, so he brought the archive computer programs and everything with him.
Okay, and this is something that is very important these days. In other words, it's a mode that many scientists and researchers are using to share information and to talk about new ideas and all these sorts of things. Is that correct?
Right, because the way things were done before and still are is you publish your findings in a technical journal, and it can take anywhere from 4 or 5 months to 4 or 5 years.
Sure.
In the case, for example, of my paper in Astrophysics Journal, I first sent them the copy in 78 and was published in 85. So there you have 7 years to
wow.
get one article published.
Wow.
And the more controversial or astounding the findings, the more physicists will have to change their belief system, the more difficult it is.
Yeah, and you wonder
why people never get their stuff published.
Gosh, you wonder why we're stagnating the way we are. My
exactly.
gosh. My
yeah.
gosh.
If you want my opinion, the major problems of society are created by the physicists today. If you want to find who is to blame, if you're looking around for where is the blame for the global warming, for what's going on, all our problems that we're facing, you better look at the physicists. They're the ones that are holding us back.
Mm-hmm.
Not just physicists, but just scientists in general.
I have to agree with that. I feel like we're in the middle of a sort of scientific dark age, even though there's some tremendous work going on and incredible discoveries, including the things that you're doing yourself. There is such an overwhelming aura of, it's suppression is the only word that I can think of. There's such an unwillingness to change, regardless of whether it will bring benefit to our planet or to the people that live here or whatever. It's just it seems like we're just stuck in a rut, and it's amazing because it's happening in many, like you say, many different areas of human endeavor.
Physicists have set up taboo areas. that if you do any work in these certain territories, taboo territories, you're ostracized.
Mm-hmm.
For example, anti-gravity, speculation about UFOs, crop circles.
Galactic core outbursts, perhaps, in ancient mythology?
Yeah, I think, for example, the idea of a physicist like myself writing a book tying in ancient myths with modern science concepts sticks in the throat of some of these thought police of the physicist community.
Right.
They don't even want to see what is written. Immediately they're thinking, oh, he based his theories on astrology or something like this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they come up with all sorts of crazy ideas.
Right, so rather than verify the information in the paper and make a judgment on a reasonable base,
it's all emotional. It's sort of like, oh, you stepped on the wrong square,
right.
You're branded, you know.
Right, and as soon as they see
the guy.
It
doesn't matter what you said, just because you went in that area, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been attacked by American Physical Society, by the top people, you know, writing things that they make up crazy stories, kind of like the negative ads you get in the political campaigns,
right.
Where they make up baloney that's
right.
Not true.
Right, and you know,
exactly
like,
the same thing.
Right,
they were claiming I infiltrated the patent office. I was part of some conspiracy to bring open-minded people into the patent office.
Oh my gosh!
As if that's bad.
Right.
But I was part of this plot, and then I get fired 2 weeks later. After this was brought to the attention of my director.
Yeah.
It was this kind of stuff that was going on.
Well, unfortunately, that's an all too familiar story. Like you say, if for whatever reason, and you can talk about the reasons. You know, that's a whole another show. Why are they doing these sorts of things? But certainly, it's unfortunately a common story with people who are doing incredible work and pushing the envelope and breaking paradigms and those people are, and you know, it's a historical. There are so many precedents historically. We talk about, you know, how advanced we are and forward thinking and all this sort of stuff. Yet the sort of thing that you're experiencing here is no different than what Galileo went through, or numerous and you know a myriad other people over time who have had similar things happen to them. And over time,
I'm not
time,
the only one to be blocked from posting his paper on this physics archive.
Mm-hmm.
There's a group, and we have a links to their experiences. For example, includes even a Nobel laureate who tried to help a fellow who's actually a Los Alamos scientist upload his research to the archive. The fact that it was on cold fusion was a no-no. I hear cold fusion. American Physical Society cronies like Robert Park,
right.
Head of the publicity department, they
right,
continually
right.
Castigate people who are doing cold fusion research as if they're doing voodoo physics or something.
You know, you may or may not be familiar, but there's a gentleman who's doing work at MIT on cold fusion, and I've been trying to get him to do a show with me because I think that he's doing some incredible stuff. And you know what? They've got this poor guy so beat up and so nervous and uncomfortable that he's not even willing to talk to little old me, you know, on the radio to talk about some of his ideas and theories and the things that he has learned. And to me, that is such a slap in the face of science itself, because like you say, science is about reason and research and discovery. It is not about marrying theories, and is not about religion and belief.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the thought police, this clique of people that have worked their way into positions of power in not only the American Physical Society, but in the State Department. Can you imagine
the
guy operating the State Department that got a cold fusion conference canceled working with American Physical Society.
At a time when we need these things more than ever, because we have a planet in peril, you know?
Well, let me tell you, it goes beyond that. The American Physical Society holds courses at MIT training future science writers for newspapers on how to approach science subjects.
There you go.
It's an effect. It's no different from the Al-Qaeda recruiting their terrorists.
Right.
And so they give them this slant that, okay, if it's anything UFOs, you're supposed to make fun of it. If it's anything on free energy that's going to create a machine that's going to help humanity by producing power for free,
it must be debunked.
You better damn well make fun of it.
That's right.
And that's exactly what they do.
Yeah, and it's been going on for quite some time, and I think it's intensifying because there are so many of these things that are tremendous discoveries and tremendous inventions and things that are sort of they're trying to make their way onto the radar, and it almost seems, and this is the conspiracy side of me talking, but it almost seems like, you know, there's a concerted effort to make sure that a lot of this stuff, and I guess I mean technology, you know, not the theories themselves, but the results of these theories, the technology that may be available because of them, that those things are just not a part of the plan. And it probably has to do with control and lots of other things, but it's certainly really, really frustrating.
Belief. I'm not sure yet if there's a conspiracy or if it's people with stupid beliefs. Picture these people with diapers, you know, and that's about the size of it.
Right. Well, it's really unfortunate, but like we're talking about, we're not taking it sitting down. You're doing a lot of great work outside of your regular scope of work over there at Archive Freedom. You and the other group of scientists that are trying to stand up to this, which is nothing less than censorship, and a lot of this is funded by the National Science Foundation, which is funded with taxpayer money, which I pay and you pay, and quite frankly, there is, in my opinion, no reason that certainly people like yourself should be barred from posting in those archives. As you say, at the website itself, there are a number of parameters that have to be met if a post is to go up on the archive, and yours clearly qualify as postable material and all that sort of thing, and there's just no reason why this stuff shouldn't be shared, especially with other scientists who are the ones that really can if they were cooperative could really help advance these things.
I went because you're supposed to get a sponsor. If you're not with a university, which I'm not presently with a university,
mm-hmm.
you're supposed to get a scientist who's posted on the archive before to sponsor you, which I followed all their rules, which they had posted there, what you're supposed to do, and I followed them to a T, and they didn't respond to the first person I gave as sponsor. Then I found a Nobel laureate who was willing to sponsor me.
Hmm.
He's one of the fathers of the Big Bang Theory, Hans Bethe.
Yes,
came up with the idea of the stars are powered by fusion energy.
Sure, I'm familiar.
And they ignored his call. He doesn't have email, but he called the office stating his support. They didn't even respond.
Amazing.
And finally, I went and got a third sponsor who had posted exactly on the topic of the Pioneer Effect. And in the end, they just say, we advise you to publish this in a journal. Now, why are they applying a different set of standards to me
right.
when everyone else, they allow them before publication
right.
in a journal?
Right.
And the thing was, this Pioneer Effect is being actively discussed on this archive where people will post papers with their explanations.
Right.
And I feel like I'm shut out.
Oh, I can't imagine how frustrating that must be, actually. I can't imagine. Well, okay, on a more positive note, let's talk about the Starburst Foundation then.
Mm.
Okay? And what we're trying to do to help alleviate some of this. But let's take a break first, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. This is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. My guest is Dr. Paul LaViolette. And we'll be back in just a few minutes. All right, that was a Tragically Hip from Trouble in the Hen House. And speaking of Trouble in the Hen House, let's get back to Dr. Paul LaViolette. We're talking about the Starburst Foundation, and this will finish up that interview. If I don't have a chance to say good night, thanks for listening to the program. Stick around or come around again next weekend. Same time, same place for Radio Orbit. And bring your wallet, bring your checkbook, because I'm going to be begging for money
because the pledge drive starts on Monday. So thanks again for listening. Next week we'll be doing a live show from London, England, talking to Nick Cook, the former aerospace editor for Jane's Defense Weekly. And again, we'll be talking about some of these new and incredible technologies that are peeking their way out from behind the curtain. Get ready for it. It's coming, people, and they can't stop it. Take care. Radio Orbit, KOPN, back in a week.
Well, the Starburst Foundation was formed to study the galactic core explosion phenomenon.
Okay, and let me cut in real fast again. We kind of cut away from the galactic core explosion idea, and gosh, we could talk so much more about this, but let's do a little bit of a quick overview of that again, just to clarify what the implications of this theory are, that we have regularly occurring outbursts from the core that do what? That cause problems?
Okay, the cosmic rays come. When they arrive at the solar system, they begin vaporizing comet material, the frozen debris that's outside the solar system. And space is just loaded. In fact, there's a ring of, it's like an asteroid belt outside Saturn, now they found. It's just loaded with frozen cometary debris.
Okay.
And this stuff gets vaporized and produces a nebula around the solar system.
Holy
so now
cow.
All the stars that we see normally now become blotted out. Or there'll be very strange, weird, grotesque forms. By the way, you know the holiday, Halloween?
Mm-hmm.
It's a Druid holiday or commemorating these strange of things were going on.
Is that right?
And so when you see an Halloween idea of ghosts going across the sky and strange things in the sky, this is a memory of what the sky was looking like. It was very frightening.
Very interested. I did a Halloween special a few weeks ago, and we talked about some of these Druidic and Celtic traditions, and that actually makes sense now in hindsight.
And the whole idea of people going door to door trick or treat, it's because people were reduced to the state of becoming everyone kind of beggars. When this catastrophe hit, civilization collapsed.
Wow.
People were going and seeking help from other people.
Incredible.
So what it happens now is this stuff is blown into the solar system, and there's a sort of a battle that goes on between the solar wind, which is pushing it out, and this galactic wind, which is trying to push it in.
Okay.
And eventually, let's say the galactic wind initially overpowers this stuff. It comes spiraling into the sun. It forms a cocoon around the sun. So the sun is putting out a lot of its energy, but now it's more infrared, it's very reddish. All this changes climate on the Earth because infrared is more easily absorbed in the atmosphere than visible light. You get inversion conditions where the atmosphere gets very sort of energized, sort of like these super storms that you hear about in
mm-hmm.
these movies.
Mm-hmm.
This is what was going on then. If you study the ice core record, during the ice age, there was 100 times more dust in the air because of the windiness. It's just incredible atmospheric energy at that time.
And again, that's something that you discovered and it shows up in the ice core, right?
Right. I was proposing this interplanetary hothouse effect because now you'd be getting not only radiation from the sun directly, but scattered radiation from this nebula of dust. You'd have the sun in the opposite direction, which is the light of our sun scattered off of these dust particles. This is called Guggenheim today. In those days, it would be very bright. And so all of these things would have created, either cooling effects or warming. Depends. You have to model this to see the results.
Right. But obviously, major change is possible when something like this happens.
Well, actually, there's a smoking gun that shows what initially happened. Now, this is the discovery of this acidity peak in the Antarctic ice core.
Ah, yes.
When I first discovered it, the thing that keyed me in that this had happened was I found that the zodiac's actually a cipher, a cryptogram, that talks about this explosion, and it points out with arrow indicators the location of the galactic center.
which we talked about a little bit earlier, the tail of Scorpio and the arrow of Sagittarius, correct?
Yeah. I know to hear so many unbelievable things in a short time from me, you know, probably a lot of the people out there are saying, this guy's got to be nuts. We can't believe all this. Well, it's just I'm trying to put a lot in a short time.
Yeah,
I can't present you all the data and so on, but go and see for yourself. It's in my book, Earth Under Fire.
Yeah, and my audience is sophisticated enough that they will not discount the things they're hearing tonight. I present a lot of information on this program that might be considered out there or whatever, but as we know and as history has proven over and over again, the people on the fringe, the pioneers, are typically the heretics of their day. And so
look at it this way. The proof is in the pudding, or whatever the expression is.
Right.
It was from that discovery I did the research and made the predictions, and now what I say was 13 or 14 predictions have been verified. So there must have been some truth to this. Otherwise, why would I get all those things right?
Right. We're not just getting lucky here. So.
But what was interesting, there was a date indicated, because this arrow indicator in the myth says that Scorpius is shooting at the heart of the scorpion. And if you look at the arrow of Sagittarius, it's not aimed presently at the heart of the scorpion, but it was on a certain date. And that comes out about 15,800 years ago.
Okay, so if you look at a star chart and then do the reversal, go back in time 15,000 years, those alignments will look better.
Yeah, you know how constellations change over time.
Sure.
Because the stars are moving.
Right.
Proper motion of the stars. And by the way, to do this, I had to do some pretty sophisticated cartography. You have to put it on a galactic coordinate system and then correct for cartographic distortion and so on.
Hmm.
The fact that you're using a Mercator projection.
My gosh, so very complicated.
Account, all this.
Right.
And you can be off by several hundred years if you don't do the right corrections. But I came up with this date, and I figured, well, from the cipher, because it's actually telling a story symbolically,
okay.
It's talking about this being the date of the arrival of this core explosion.
Wow.
These cosmic rays. This was way back in the 70s or so that I was discovering this. And then I wrote it up, Earth Under Fire, was in print in 79 in Earth Under Fire. It was in print in the published articles before then, this date I came up with. So now, very recently, they found an Antarctic ice core. These acidity peaks, they couldn't understand what they were. They spanned about a century, where the acidity of the ice had hydrogen chloride, HCl,
mm-hmm.
and hydrogen fluoride, and were going up and down in concentration over a decade or about. And they couldn't understand, because no volcanic eruption would do this. You know, volcanic eruptions occur erratically. They don't put out so much material. This was like 20 times more material than any of the strongest volcanic eruptions anyone knew about.
Okay.
And when I looked at this, I thought, well, they got their dates a little wrong. You have to update their dating system with the latest findings, because now we could peg the Antarctic scale to the Greenland scale, which is very accurately dated. When I did that, you come out with this date 15,800 years ago.
Huh.
And you notice that this regular period of variation matches the solar cycle.
Wow.
And so that's like a fingerprint showing that this is cosmic. In other words,
right.
That means that those gases and that dust there had to come from space, because it's being modulated by the cycle of the sun.
Right, I understand. I'm with you.
And so now this paper has been accepted. It's coming out shortly in Planetary and Space Science. It's you can download it from my website. And I'm also trying to upload to this archive, and have been blocked, though it's been accepted for publication.
Right, this is a paper.
So far, they've been blocking me. I'm hoping that it will finally come to their senses to allow this to go on, too.
Right.
Oh, well, I mean, I could go on and on about the core explosion phenomenon, about the burning of the Earth. I mean, it was how it energizes the sun.
Well, you know, I guess before we stop talking about it, the question that everyone's going to tell me to ask you is, do we have any idea how frequent this happens? It's obviously something that's based on cycles. Are we close to the end of a cycle? Are we in the middle of a cycle? What do we think?
Well, I think we're overdue for another event, but I can't tell you when it's going to come. Everyone will want to say, okay, can we look out and see it coming?
Right.
The problem is that it travels towards us at the speed of light. These are cosmic rays.
Mm-hmm.
So when you see the light from the explosion at the center of the galaxy, the cosmic rays are already on your doorstep.
Here.
There's no time to prepare. You might have days before the very energetic cosmic rays start coming in, and they're going to be pushing cosmic dust. The cosmic dust would take maybe a matter of months to migrate inward.
Mm-hmm.
And then all hell breaks loose. but with the initial outburst, you could be having, because nothing like this has happened in modern times, so we can only speculate, that it will be accompanied with a gravity wave.
Mm-hmm.
And this could cause earthquakes, major earthquakes throughout the Earth. This is the one part of the theory which is difficult to verify because you cannot see gravitational effects too easily in other galaxies.
Mm-hmm.
Or in our own galaxy. It's difficult to find an evidence of it. Like, for example, cosmic rays, you have a record.
Right.
Because it produces beryllium 10 in the atmosphere, and you can get a record of cosmic ray activity, which in fact supports this theory that there were these cosmic ray volleys hitting us at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But if there's earthquakes, things would get shaken up. Then there's the possibility of EMP, sort of this electromagnetic effect of the arrival of the shock front of cosmic rays, which could overload power lines. Did you watch this Day of Destruction? They had a series on TV.
No, but certainly I've seen enough of that type of stuff to be familiar with all the different things that could happen. And
so
yeah,
this kind of stuff, we're not just in one city, but it could be all across the country, all across several countries of certain half of the globe could go dark.
Yeah, yeah. These are global type issues we're talking about for sure.
Would knock out our satellite system. Any satellites that weren't hardened for cosmic ray flares like this.
Yeah, fry all kinds of circuitry, do all kinds of things. Here come the Flintstones.
Fry your cars. You know, most automobiles have integrated chips in them.
Right, correct.
If you were driving something from 20, 30 years ago,
Meteor.
That used a distributor, and you wouldn't have any problems. But you might be lucky to be able to start your car in the morning.
Right. So,
we can only guess.
Right.
One of the purposes of Starburst is to get the world aware of this, prepare them. And one of the ways is I tried to do it through my book, through the website. We have contacted various UN representatives, gotten back some very nice letters of thanks from some of the ambassadors who felt it was something serious that we should look at.
Mm-hmm.
So far, there's no university doing research on this. It's sort of like we continue to walk in a fog.
Yeah. You know, this sort of comes up frequently, but the whole nature of the culture that we're living in right now has this sort of short-term focus, regardless of the institution. If you look at the political institutions or educational institutions, the business, all of these things are based on the short term. I mean, even two terms of a president is only 8 years. So to get the leaders of these industries, these institutions to consider and start to care more and give more attention to these things that are much more big picture, much more sort of long term in scope, is just, it seems to be almost impossible.
I would say the only hope is that this thing is several hundred years off.
Mm.
You know,
right.
We can't really tell exactly when it will come, but like some people are saying, oh, it's going to come 2012.
2012,
because
right. That's
the Mayan calendar ends right. at that time.
Right. That's certainly one.
Who knows? Maybe it could. You know, I think we're in trouble if it comes
to that. Yeah, we got 6 years, 7 years, so.
We should have been building one of the recommendations we have is to build a distributed power network so we don't depend on power lines. We should have been allowing the sale of free energy machines, for example, magnetic motors,
mm-hmm.
which is a reality. I mean, one time I was on the way to Tesla conference, and I just happened to sit next to a guy who was in charge of security at one of the secret government labs up in, where was it, Utah or somewhere.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me over there.
He describes, as I'm telling him about some of these free energy machines, he starts telling me about this magnetic motor that they're doing work on, and the darn thing is like two stories high. I mean, we're talking about pretty big project, utility size.
Right.
But it's classified. He couldn't tell me anything.
Right. Everything under the guise and under the umbrella of national security and the benefits of those technologies never seem to reach it to the people.
And now they're probably saying, "Oh, we got to keep this classified because terrorists could use this."
Right. That's been the whole idea. I think even since the early 1900s, and certainly since after World War II, right after World War II, everything changed with the National Security Act and lots of other things. But I think there's been an ongoing, continuing. Concerted effort to make sure that this stuff stays classified, for regardless of what reason. But they are keeping the stuff under wraps, and I don't know if it's strictly for control or if it's greed and power and money and oil industries and these sorts of things. But certainly, there are technologies.
It's fear, and I think they're going in the wrong direction.
Boy, it sure feels like it, Dr. LaViolette. Sure feels like it. But anyway, hey, look, we are unfortunately about at the end of our time here. But it has been a fascinating conversation, and we touched on a whole lot of different things. And I would once again request all of my listeners to do a couple of things. First of all, go to etheric.com and check out the work of this incredible gentleman who's been nice enough to spend 2 hours of his time with us tonight. And his books are available there. I own most of them, and they're incredible. They're great. They're very well written as well, and sort of take you through these adventures. This the old mythology, Paul, you know, is just incredible stuff. It's great reading because it's so well done the way that they did what they did, you know.
Yeah, it takes you in a different state of consciousness.
It sure does. It takes you away, and if you give it a chance, certainly some people will be grabbed by that and will recognize the significance of it. It happened to me many years ago. So,
and it also provides a nice framework for understanding this ancient science because it uses metaphor and it's really accessible to people even without science background.
Right, and the whole idea of science being separate from mysticism is one of the things that has caused us so much trouble, I think. And I think this is a way to at least start to think about bridging those gaps again between science and mysticism, because there really are connections there that can really move us forward, I think. So, well, in any case, okay, thank you very much again, Dr. LaViolette. And for everybody out there, one more time, www.archivefreedom.org and www.etheric.com. Please get familiar with the work of Dr. LaViolette and some of the other incredible people that are doing work in these fields. And get familiar, get involved, and let's do some things to help things move in a more positive direction. I'd love to see that.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mike.
And hopefully, if I can talk you into it, maybe down the road here in a few months, maybe sometime early, mid-next year, we can talk again and get some updates on some of the things that we're talking about and discuss some of this stuff a little bit further. There's so many things that we didn't talk about. I wanted to talk about pulsars. I wanted to talk about... oh, gosh, I wanted to talk about the riddle of the Sphinx. I wanted to talk about a lot of things, but but there's a lot. Anyway, Dr. LaViolette, Dr. Paul LaViolette, a fantastic scientist and a great guest, and thank you very much for being with us tonight on Radio Orbit. And like I said, we'll talk to you again sometime, okay?
All Okay.
All right, everybody. This is Mike signing off. Radio Orbit, KOPN 89.5 FM. Listen in next week as I talk live from London with Nick Cook about anti-gravity technology.